This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
Still busy, still doing lots of reading and things. We're trying to get ahead, so we're recording this in advance.
Yes. You did hit your 100 book mark, though.
I did. I did indeed. I hit 100 books this year. I'm 50 books ahead. I'm curious how many I will get through by the time we hit December.
You're halfway through the year right now, and you're at 100 books. This is crazy.
And I'm at 100 books. I'm really proud of myself.
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah, I've done a lot. Who am I?
I mean, it's amazing that you've gotten through so many with everything else that you have on your plate.
I have not really been watching a lot of TV or really listening to music. I've just been like listening to books and like reading books.
I like that. It's good for your brain.
It's been great. I'm so curious to see what my Spotify Wrapped will be.
Oh, that'll be interesting. Oh, do they do it for books now?
Well, I only listen to like one book a month on there because they only have like a certain amount of hours that is included with every premium plan. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but I know that my time spent listening to music is usually a significant amount of time.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be that. I haven't listened to podcasts in forever. It's just books. Like podcast who? Don't know her. I'm so behind. We have a new patron that we have to announce, and I think technically we're very late on this.
So sorry.
So Sarah L, we are very grateful and very sorry.
Welcome to the Patreon run.
Yes. Hello.
Do want to say that the next full episode that we're going to do for Patreon is going to be about Edgar Cayce. And our lovely patron, Beth, is the one who requested that so long ago. Also, I am so sorry, Beth. So if you want to learn about Edgar Cayce's life, join our Patreon.
Hell
just
yeah.
Like our friends, Beth and Sarah. Thank you again, Sarah. We're so happy that you're here.
Yes, thank you. That's what I've got. What about you? Do you have any updates?
It's the 4th of July today, and this country doesn't deserve a celebration.
No, America was such a bitch on Monday. She's been a huge bitch for a really long time. I'm not going to her birthday party.
She doesn't deserve it.
I'm not going.
So I went for a hike, and it was incredibly hot. But you know what? It was another, you know what? I do have an update. It was a check off my 2024 list, since we're speaking of things that we're doing. My hobby is hiking. Now I've done 14 trails on my list, and I have 24 on my list so far right now, but I constantly add more on.
Nice.
Yeah. So halfway through the summer, and I'm like halfway through my list. It feels really good.
Yeah, you're doing great on that one. My only hiking related thing is I want to walk 50 miles with Gio.
Ooh,
this summer.
Nice.
We haven't, it's been too hot and I haven't been able to wake up early enough to take him. So I don't know where we're at with that right now.
Baby Gio.
Right?
I'm going to the Lunar Fair tomorrow. I know I brought that up last episode, but I'm so super excited. It's goth cowfolk themed this time. I am so excited.
It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah. It's at a different location than I've ever been to before, because they move around. Ooh. Each time. This one is at a place called, I think, Horseshoe Lake. Okay. I think that's why they went with the cowfolk theme. It makes sense. It's on brand.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited.
That's going to be so fun. One day I'll get up there for it.
Yes. For anyone who's listening in New Jersey, if you don't know what the Lunar Fair is, every new moon and every full moon in a different location in New Jersey, it's like vendors and crafts and a drum circle and drag performances, other kinds of performances, fire twirling. A lot of the locations usually have like covered, like tree covered paths that you can walk through. So they tell you to bring a flashlight. It's just really great. And food. And it's such a good vibe. Witchy fun vibe. So you should check it out.
Very whimsical.
Very whimsical. I love whimsy. That should be my middle name.
You can do that.
We had berries we found in the woods today. Whimsical.
So whimsical. Yeah, that's all amazing. Yeah. And I'm really jealous about it all. And I want to go to the Lunar Fair.
You have to. You're going to.
I will. One day.
Speaking of whimsy, I think today's episode is pretty whimsical.
It is a little whimsical. It is a little whimsical. And it's a little fighting against whimsy. There's a whole side to the person. Oh, well, it's in the title. It's not like it's a surprise. There's a whole side to Harry Houdini that I think a lot of people don't necessarily know about. Today, we are talking about another one of my favorite hyperfixations, the man, the myth, the legend, Harry Houdini. Is an extraordinary man who is known for his incredible ability to get himself out of almost any impossible, unbelievable situation. The reality is, though, Houdini was so much more than escapes and illusions, and we can't really talk about him without also talking about Arthur Conan Doyle, yes, the author of Sherlock Holmes, and the uprise of the spiritualism belief. Harry Houdini was born Eric Weiss, spelled W-I-E-S, in Budapest, and he travels to the U.S. from Hungary in 1878 when he was 4 years old. So he's born in 1874. Sorry, I forgot to say that math right there. As an adult, Houdini told everyone that he was born in Wisconsin, which is something that continues to pop up all the time. Like, he wrote it in his diary. He really wanted that to be his official story.
What a random state.
Well, that's where he moved to and like grew up. He was like, no, I was born here. He was not. The world that he was born into is, of course, Christianity and Puritan beliefs and all of those things still existed. But I need to do just like a quick overview of sort of the other cultural beliefs and norms of the time. Because in actuality, spiritualism was a significant cultural and religious movement in the United States during the 1870s. It emerged during the mid-19th century and continued to gain popularity throughout the post-Civil War era. Everyone lost a family member or someone they loved in the Civil War, and no one really knew how to deal with that emotionally. So people started turning to ghosts, seances, trying to communicate with the dead as almost like a way of like dealing with these emotions.
This is so interesting. Oh, I gotta talk to Lauren about this.
We say spiritualism began kind of in the late 1840s. And the two people that a lot of historians, I guess, point back to are these two young girls known as the Fox Sisters living in New York. They claim to be able to communicate with the spirits through like rapping sounds and knocks. And this sparked international interest and led to a huge spread of seances and other spiritualistic practices. So by the time Houdini was born, the 1870s, spiritualism had become a very popular movement with a pretty significant following. It attracted a diverse group of people, including those grieving lost loved ones, but it also included intellectuals and people involved in social reform. Spiritualists believed that it was possible to communicate with the spirits of the deceased through mediums, and this was often done through seances, spirit writings, and other forms of spirit contact. The whole movement provided a platform for women to take on public roles as mediums and leaders within it. And I cannot stress how significant this was in a time where women's public roles were otherwise really limited.
This is fascinating.
It became a cultural norm. Like, seances were happening in the White House. Political figures were involved. Like, it was very mainstream to, like, talk to the dead. Many spiritualists were also involved in what would be referred to as progressive causes, such as abolition, women's suffrage, and prohibition. The movement's emphasis on moral and social improvement really resonated with broader social reform movements of the time. So, like, they were pretty accepted. And this is like kind of the world that Houdini grows up in, but it's also really important to note that he was raised by a man of God. His father, Hermann Meyer Weiss, was a rabbi who for some time throughout his life led a small group of people. PBS says, quote, "Although an educated man, Weiss was not destined for success in America. His lifelong struggle to provide for his family would make a lasting impression on his son, Harry, like short for Eric. Then people started calling him Harry, who was forced to work from an early age to help him make ends meet. Not only did Houdini want to help his siblings, but it was noted many, many times that Harry was, quote, fiercely devoted to his mother. This was a huge, like, contribution to his lifelong quest to set out for a job and support his family the best he could. He had a pretty difficult time, as anyone would, balancing school and work. So he was 8 years old when he left school entirely to shine shoes and hand out newspapers, just like entirely focused on providing for the family.
So wild. Balancing school and work, and you're 8 years old.
You just at eight.
Blew my mind. But it's the same thing as last week's episode with the Titanic, like the working class families needing all of the young men to do the jobs. I couldn't leave them.
Yeah, and they were like, oh, my 10-year-old boy, he's a man. He doesn't count as women and children on the ships. Wild. Regardless of these jobs that he had taken, PBS says, quote, still the boy was drawn to performing, making his debut at a neighborhood circus as the 9-year-old trapeze artist that he referred to as Eric, the Prince of the Air. It's really cute. In 1887, after several unsuccessful rabbinic appointments in the Midwest, Herman Meyerweiss moved to New York with his young son. The two of them resided in a boarding house and took on various jobs to make a living. Eventually, their family did join them when they had enough money to bring everyone. After hearing of and visiting Coney Island for the first time, young Harry was entranced and in love with the life of performing. After seeing the weird and wonderful sideshow acts, he began to learn the skills that would be the base of his future illusions. He already had been practicing close-up magic and knew some card tricks, but it was here where he learned the intense training behind it. So, like, learning how to relax certain muscles in his throat would lead him to the ability to swallow keys and other things for his act, which became, like, really fucking important. At one point in his adult life, he actually pulled out 50 threaded needles, like, on a string from his mouth. It's crazy. He also began training, running 5 miles a day in Central Park, refusing to drink alcohol or smoke with the understanding that he needed to keep his body in peak physical condition. In the spare time that he had, he excelled in sports such as swimming, boxing, and running, truly honing the athletic skills that would be crucial for his future performances. And in that way, he was training for his future. And at the same time, rekindling this like passion for magic that he had always had. It wasn't until 1889 at 17 that we see the name he would be most known by when he partnered up with, according to the New Yorker, his brother Dash, to form an act called the Brothers Houdini. Harry chose this name because he was particularly inspired by the work of the famed French conjurer Jean-Eugène Robert Houdini.
That is fun to say.
Super, super fun. So he thought that when he added the I to the end of the name, it meant like in French. So that, like, by adding the I and being Houdini, he thought he was saying like Houdini, which didn't really translate. But I at the end of a name in Hungarian means belong to. So, like, I kind of see where the mishap happened. The two of them, his brother, Dash, and him, would perform a trick known as metamorphosis. So Harry would be, like, locked up and tied into a sack and then tied into a locked trunk and bind the trunk with rope. So it's, like, super duper locked. They would conceal this mega locked contraption for a few seconds. And when they opened the curtain, Dash, the brother, would be tied up in the trunk and Harry would be free. They would, like, switch spots in, like, a matter of seconds. And it blew people's mind. They just had no idea how they were able to unlock everything and switch locks so quickly. And people were obsessed with it. It's around this same time that Harry's father passes from cancer. He had already carried the burden and the stress of feeling like he needed to provide for his family. And now without his dad to kind of like be another person doing the same thing, he knew, he was like, I have to succeed. There's no other answers. He's 18 years old and he is like, okay, the best way that I'm going to be able to support you guys is if I go out looking for the crowds rather than waiting for them to come to me in the world. While he's out trying to make a name for himself and sending money back to his mom and siblings, he meets Bess, a dancer, and the two of them quickly fall in love and get married, like within 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
It's also the 1800s.
Yeah, but that is fast.
It's fast. The marriage is like solid. It lasts for the rest of their lives. And Houdini is on quote saying like, this is the one shackle I don't want to escape from.
Aww. That's a cute sentiment.
He loved Bess, and his love for Bess, however, did not change his fierce loyalty to his mother. He always had a picture of the three of them, him, his mom, and Bess. And at the top of it, he wrote, my two sweethearts. The two people that Harry relied on entirely for his performance were his brother and Bess, and he entrusted them with everything, including the secrets behind his tricks. The most dramatic story. At midnight one night, he brought them to the spot on a bridge to like overlook New York City and waited for the clock to chime, and then made his brother and wife swear an oath to never tell the secrets of how he did his act. Going forward, after the marriage, Harry and Beth became stage partners, and they were the two on stage for his performances, like Metamorphosis and everything going forward. Houdini was impressive, but regardless of his skill, he wasn't getting the fame that he knew he was capable of. His close-up magic was okay, and his tricks were interesting, but what people were more impressed with was the speed in which he completed things like Metamorphosis. In the 1980s, while trying to make money, Houdini and Bess looked around and kind of saw the world of spiritualism and kind of dabbled in what they referred to as the quote scam, or excuse me, 1880s.
Okay, sorry.
Dabbled in what they referred to as quote, the scam of spiritualism. So they would travel to towns and do research on names at local graveyards at night. And then the next day put on shows where they would summon the dead in public to put on a seance performance, etc. He did not feel good about that. He didn't like it. So he stopped doing that and really starts focusing on experimenting with different forms of escaping. With these acts that he starts building, he catches the attention of Martin Beck, an entertainment manager who quickly got him booked at some of the best vaudeville venues in the country and followed that with a tour of Europe. He's like, I'm going to put you in the world, kid. Like, we're doing this. And his big thing is escaping from handcuffs. He is known as the Handcuff King. He goes around the cities, like he'll come to a city and he'll make like a big hubbub by going to the police and demanding to be thrown in jail, and then they'll put him in jail and he'll escape.
Wow.
So the cops would like strip search him, place him in shackles, lock him in their jails, throw like a whole thing like, you can't escape from this, it's impossible. And he would escape and everyone was like, oh my God, did you see? He's putting on a show tomorrow night. And then it would make his show sold out because everyone wanted to see what else he could do.
Wow.
He quickly, with this setup, became the highest paid performer in American vaudeville, like the top of his craft. He would come into a town and by the time he left, everyone was talking about him. So when he got to London in this European tour, he was a little bit ready to kind of be welcomed by some crowds. He was expecting a little bit of a hubbub, but he got there and no one really knew who he was. So he was like, all right, bet, fine, let's go.
Gotta do it again.
Okay, I'll show you what to do. So I'm just gonna read straight from the article. The King of Handcuffs, how Harry Houdini, American, surprised the British. And this was like published when he performed. When Harry Houdini, the American King of Handcuffs, arrived in England, he tried to arrange for an exhibit of his skill at Scotland Yard, but the authorities refused to allow him an opportunity of putting on or taking off the article handcuffs. that like bar of handcuffs that has like, that's the type of handcuffs that he wanted them to put on him. They're like impossible, inescapable, whatever. When they refused to do it, he went with a London manager and asked if he could pay, like, just like a, do a tour as an American visitor to the police headquarters, and kind of like played it off that he was just a regular person following this guide that they offered of like some of the things that they used to do and things like that, and tricked the guide into taking the handcuffs down. And the guide took them down and was like, oh, these are handcuffs, they're impossible to remove, and tricked the guide into putting the handcuffs on him to show him that, and then escaped from the impossible handcuffs.
Wow.
He tricked his way into completing this trick.
That's pretty amazing.
And they're just like, oh, you crazy guy, you. He was like so charming, it was hard to not just be wowed by him. Mm-hmm. The most popular thing about him was that all of his acts like this were performed in public. Most other people were just only doing this stuff on stages, in houses, or in very controlled environments. Harry, on the other hand, is offering a completely free 360-degree view look at his seemingly impossible feats. PBS says, Houdini returned to America in 1905 and put down roots by buying a small farm in Connecticut and a stately brownstone in Manhattan. Although being an entertainer meant constant travel, the brownstone became a home base for his family, particularly his mom. Houdini had always been close to his mother, but since his father's death, had demonstrated a fierce devotion rivaled only by his love for Bess.
Aww.
As he continued around the United States, he found himself just continuously trying to one-up anything that he had done before. So he went from handcuffs, and he's like, all right, I'm bored from escaping from handcuffs, to straitjackets.
Oh.
To straitjackets hanging upside down, to handcuffs and straitjackets hanging upside down, dunked over water, eventually he was in water-filled tanks or nailed packing crates. In some of the sources that I read and watched, people would lightly explain some of the theories that they had about Houdini's secrets behind escaping. But at the end of the day, he was able to escape because of both his uncanny strength and his equally uncanny ability to pick locks. He had honed the perfect amount of skills to just be at the top of his craft. By 1906, he was throwing himself chained into inhospitable bodies of water, dropping 25 feet off of the Belle Isle Bridge, for instance, into the freezing Detroit River.
What?
So he arrived in late November of 1906 to perform for 2 weeks at the Temple Theater. While he was performing his, you know, public feat that drew a lot of attention, he jumped from the Belle Isle Bridge, bound with restraints. According to Houdini, he leapt handcuffed, chained, and leg ironed into a small hole cut into the frozen river.
What?
Houdini claimed that he was swept away by the current and stayed alive by breathing into air bubbles between the ice until he found a hole. In a 1953 movie, this was embellished even further by the actor depicting Houdini swimming under the ice for 8 minutes, but that's not how long it was. This incident was one of his most famous exploits. The front page of the Detroit News from 1906 tells a slightly different story. He was, in fact, tied, handcuffed, and bound. He did leap from the Belle Isle Bridge, and he freed himself while underwater, then swam to a waiting lifeboat, passed over the unlocked and open cuffs, and clambered aboard. So the river wasn't fully frozen. Regardless, the escape was a remarkable feat. And still, like, very incredible. It's just, like, it's been embellished a little bit over time.
Yeah.
So I want to clear that up slightly. He did a lot of other shit. He developed a passion for aviation while in Europe in the early 1900s, bought a plane, and became one of the first world's private pilots. The world's first private pilot. Like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? He did, at one point, crash during his maiden flight in Germany, but continued to practice and eventually set his sights on becoming the first man to pilot an airplane in Australia, which he did do.
Oh, he's a goal setter and a goal achiever, and I appreciate
that. He just goes for it. It's amazing. In 1912, his stage act, because he did still perform on stages, reached its pinnacle with what is known as the Chinese Water Torture Cell, and it is the hallmark of his career. Houdini is suspended upside down by his feet and lowered into a locked glass cabinet that fills with water, requires to hold his breath for more than 3 minutes to escape. The performance is so daring and such a crowd pleaser that it remained in his act until his death.
This is...
Have you ever seen it?
I don't think so. This is insane. The fact that he was putting himself through this and so easily.
It's really, really, really scary.
Yeah. This is terrifying. He's doing, like, terrifying things that could kill him.
Yeah, and people have tried to recreate it and have died.
Oh, my God.
I did successfully see someone do it in, like, the research that I've done. Like, people can still do this, but a lot of people have tried to recreate the things that Harry Houdini did and have died. It gets sad now.
Aww.
Harry Houdini's life turns fully upside down when word of his mother's death reaches him in Sweden in 1913. When it happened, Houdini reportedly fainted, and then when he came to, wept uncontrollably.
Oh, he loved his mom so much.
He loved her. Quote, "I am what would be called the mother's boy," admitted the man hailed around the world as a real-life Superman. He grieved the loss of his mother for the rest of his life.
Oh.
Houdini once wrote that it was the crushing loss of his mother in 1913 that set him on a single-minded search for a genuine spirit medium.
Wow.
Some Houdini experts argue otherwise. They think that because he was already kind of dabbling in the world of, like, believing that spiritualism was a scam, mm-hmm. and, like, doing it as a scam, that he was already had his toes into it. You'll see. The other side of this is that people were starting rumors about him almost being supernatural or having some sort of real magic because he did such impossible things that they couldn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
The New Yorker says, quote, "In 1920, Harry Houdini became friends with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of the most logical man in the popular literature, paradoxically, was devoted to spiritualism. Doyle was convinced that he had communicated in seances with his son Kingsley, who was wounded in the Great War and died in the influenza epidemic of 1918.
Oh my gosh.
In between writing stories about Sherlock Holmes, Doyle wrote books announcing that humanity had entered into, quote, new relations with the unseen.
Whoa.
He believed that Harry Houdini, for one, possessed supernatural powers. Houdini was flattered, but disavowed any special help. They remained, like, friends who disagreed and would have, like, pleasant debates mm-hmm. about their disbeliefs until June of 1922, when Doyle and his wife, who was a practicing medium, invited Houdini into their suite at a hotel in Atlantic City. Lady Doyle seated the party around a table, rapped three times, and began communicating, quote, with Houdini's adored mother, who at this time had been dead for 9 years. She wrote out 15 pages of messages.
Whoa.
And Houdini sat there quietly, thanked his hosts, and departed. The messages were written in English, and his mother only ever spoke to him in German. There were also crosses at the top of the messages. And she was a devout Jewish woman married to a rabbi. And he knew that this was fake. And he was fucking furious.
I would be too. That's such a ripoff. And, like, that's someone that you're supposed to be friends with. How dare you? How dare you do that? That's so disrespectful to the memory of his mother.
So after this, he embarked on his second career as a professional skeptic and debunker of psychics, mind readers, mediums, and all other spiritualists who perpetrated the idea that they were able to contact the dead.
A professional debunker. I like that.
Oh, yeah. He was the first Mythbuster.
Oh, my. This is amazing.
He was like, I have $10,000 for any psychic who can present evidence of the physical phenomenon that cannot otherwise be explained rationally. And no one could ever collect.
Wow.
He was like, that's right. I'm going to expose the entire fucking movement. He would, in public, challenge famous mediums and began putting on lectures about, quote, fraudulent spiritualistic phenomena. By his own estimate, he investigated hundreds of spiritualists over a 35-year span.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. This meant more to him than anything.
He's like, fuck that other shit. This is my life's work.
This is, like, he cared so much about this.
Wow.
His participation in one of the investigations dominated international headlines for years prior to a trip to Washington, D.C. In 1924, at the behest of Conan Doyle, Scientific American, which was like basically the old-timey 60 Minutes of their time, is like what the sources said. They were just like, they were the investigative journalists.
Mm-hmm.
So Arthur Conan Doyle was like, I'm going to put forward my own prize money to anyone who can prove that they're talking to mediums under these very strict conditions. Mm-hmm. They formed a jury of scientific men. They counted Houdini as one of their members to show that, like, they are really trying to do this.
Yeah.
Like, in so many aspects, they are trying to look for someone who can prove it. After dismissing several contestants, the committee focused... Oh, this is from Smithsonian Magazine.
Okay.
The committee focused its attentions on the upper-class Boston medium named Marjorie Crandon, who was the wife of a Harvard-trained doctor. Her performance, if a deception, suggested a magician's talent rivaling Houdini. So she would be physically slumped in a trance...
Mm-hmm.
Her hands controlled by others. Crandon channeled a spirit that reportedly whispered in the ears of seance sitters, pinched them, poked them, pulled their hair, floated roses under their noses, and even moved objects and furniture in the room.
Whoa.
So she was putting on a fucking show. And a lot of other people, including the chief organizer, were like, oh no, she's doing it. She is for sure magic. And Houdini was like, you guys are too close to her. I see right through this.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, she's very attractive and is using her sexuality to flirt with men and disarm them, says Joe Nickel, a one-time magician and Pinkerton agency detective who has enjoyed a fabled career as a paranormal investigator. What a quote.
Yes.
Houdini was like, no, I see through this. And he was really, really nervous that they were actually going to award her the prize.
Mm-hmm.
So preemptively, he issued a 40-page pamphlet called Houdini Exposes the Tricks Used by Boston Medium Marjorie. Like, not even...
He didn't hold back.
Not even trying to pretend like it was about something else. And he outlines exactly how she could have done all of these things.
Yeah.
And convinces the magazine to not give the prize money.
Wow.
He's doing a lot. He is pissing off an entire group of people.
Yes, he is.
All of the spiritualists are like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? Because at the end of the day, if they're not communicating with the dead, at the very least, a lot of these people believed that they were offering a way for these people to move on
mm-hmm.
and be able to, like, give closure to the loss of their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, we're trying to offer something. Of course, some people are going to take advantage, but like some people were very much so into this. And he was really pissing them off. It's 1926 where he testifies before Congress about what he refers to as the spiritualist menace.
Oh, he is so serious about this.
He is so serious. people trying to be like, these words are for your mother. He was like, oh, fuck you. He was real mad. So he arrives in Washington for the congressional hearings and finds, quote, a city steeped in spiritualism. Everyone is all about it. At a May 1926 hearing, Rose Mackenberg, a woman Houdini had employed to investigate and document the practices of local mediums, detailed her undercover visit to a spiritualist leader, Jane B. Coates, testifying that the medium told her during a consultation that Houdini's campaign was pointless, saying that what was said to her, why try and fight spiritualism when most of the senators are interested in the subject? I know for a fact that there have been spiritual seances held in the White House with President Coolidge and his family.
Wow.
So Houdini would hire people, send them into towns before he got there to scope out all of the spiritualists and learn what they were doing, show up to their shows and would stand up and be like, I'm Houdini and this is how they're doing this. And they would just be like, oh, what the fuck?
Oh.
Like, he'd basically like throw on the lights and be like, look the string. They're scamming you.
Oh my God.
And now him and his people are testifying to that. In his testimony, he full on shows the entire room how all of these tricks were done. Saying to the Los Angeles Times later, it takes a flim-flammer to catch a flim-flammer.
Takes one to know one.
Basically, yeah. He showed all of the legislator how messages from the beyond that mysteriously appeared could be concocted and advanced, concealed from view and later. He showed how they could make it look like people are whispering in your ears with like a long, almost like the record player trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
He debunked every single thing that all 300 fortune tellers, spirit mediums, and astrologers who came to the hearings to defend themselves were doing as their jobs. There were so many spiritualists and mediums that they couldn't fit in the room. They were hanging from windows, sitting on the floor, filling the corridor. The Evening Star reported, quote, the House caucus room today was thrown into turmoil for more than an hour while Harry Houdini, psychic investigator, and scores of spiritualists, mediums, and clairvoyants had verbal and almost physical battles over his determination to push through legislation in the district prohibiting fortune telling in any form. End
Whoa,
quote.
I did not know that he did all this.
Oh, yeah. He was like, y'all are taking advantage of people. This should be fucking illegal. And that's why I said he's a little against the whimsy.
This is wild.
He's a little against it. Other people, Kentucky representative Wild, Ralph Gilbert, argued that, quote, the gentleman is taking the entire matter too seriously, end quote.
I think he might be right, though.
Others thought the magician was soliciting Congress's participation in a witch trial. A Houdini expert explains, Houdini was trying to draw the traditional crowd against witchcraft, against these heretical superstitious practices in a predominantly Christian nation, to try and promote a bill that was just kind of a blatant encroachment on First Amendment prerogatives. The hearsay implication, like, so people were saying, like, yeah, exactly. And a lot of the people involved in the spiritualist movement were saying, quote, my religion goes back to Jesus Christ. Houdini does not know I'm a Christian, end quote. So these spiritualists are like fully accepted by Christians.
Yeah.
Like, they're not against it. Houdini literally retorted, Jesus was a Jew and he didn't charge $2 a visit.
Oh my God.
So quick. So quick. In the end, the bill on mediumship died in the committee. Mm-hmm. It never went anywhere.
Yeah.
When members of Congress advised Houdini that the First Amendment protected spiritualism, however fraudulent its practitioners may be, Houdini protested that, quote, everyone who practices as a medium is a fraud. Gilbert, a former judge, countered, "I concede all that, but what is the use of us legislating about it? A fool and his money are soon to be parted."
Oh.
Basically, just like, if that's how they want to spend their money, if they believe it, then they do it, and it's not our right to tell them that they can't do it. Mm-hmm. So he continued traveling all around the country, interrupting seances, sometimes in disguise, shouting, "I am Houdini," as he flipped over tables and demanded that lights be turned on, trashing events for performers and hopeful listeners alike.
Whoa.
He was like, "If you're going to keep doing this, I'm not going to fucking let you." Mm-hmm. That just sort of continued. Houdini v. Spiritualists. Oh. Until Friday, October 22nd, 1926, when a McGill University approaches Houdini before his show. And they're just talking. And he, this is something that Houdini does all the time, is he lets people punch him in the stomach. Oh. Because he talks about how he can just be punched and be fine. And Houdini accepted the challenge. But before he could do his physical preparation and tighten the muscles that he needed to do, the kid just punched.
Oh, no.
Regardless of that fact, Houdini just continued to perform his last four shows before traveling to by train to Detroit and collapsing after his first show.
Holy shit.
Houdini spent a week in the hospital and whispered to his brother Theo, "I'm tired of fighting. Guess this is going to get me." Took one last glance at his wife Bess, closed his eyes, and died at 1:26 p.m. on Sunday, October 31st, 1926.
On Halloween.
1 month prior, an old woman had come to one of Houdini's shows and told him, "You will not make it to November."
Stop, I just got chills.
Many people argue that he died of peritonitis and appendicitis. His appendix had ruptured, and when they opened him up for surgery, trigger warning, the surgeons say that it was just like a ton of pus just came out. Like, he was so he super infected. There's just no way that he was going to be able to get through it.
Yeah.
There are some people who believe that Houdini pissed off enough spiritualists that they poisoned him.
Oh.
And that goes in line with the spiritualist medium telling him, "You're not going to make it to November." There is no confirmed, we will never know.
Yeah.
Just a rumor. And there's, it's still the mysterious death of Harry Houdini.
Wow.
Was it his appendix rupturing? Was it the infection? Who knows? Before dying, Bess and Harry had agreed upon a code word, so that if anyone tried to approach her after his death, telling her that he had a message, they would be able to be vetted specifically by this code word. Mm. Bess continued to hold seances after his death every year on Halloween. And before hers in 1943, Bess Houdini declared the experiment a failure, saying that if there were ever a way to escape from the afterlife and communicate with the loved ones, if anyone could do it, it's Harry Houdini. And since she didn't get her vetted message, she died believing that it is not possible to communicate with the dead. Regardless, to this day, Halloween seances are held in attempts to contact the man that could escape anything. And that is Harry Houdini and his life.
Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Katie.
You're so welcome. Ooh, under an hour too.
Wow, good for me. Look at that. I'm so proud of you. An hour and a half to edit. That took me a while last time.
That's a lot. That's a lot to edit.
Thank you so much. Oh, I love that I learned so much about him. The Halloween thing is crazy. I did not know that he died on Halloween.
I know, the man who like hated the spooky. Just has like the spookiest end of them all.
Yes. All right. Well, until next week. Bye.
Bye. For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2K Podcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2K Podcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.